There's a documentary film that explores the apparatus behind the making of a sex scene in the movies and television. So the choreography and the prosthetics, the body doubles, but it's more than that, really. The film is about the way women's bodies have been portrayed in cinema over the years. It's called Body Parts, and it's the latest in our film series. We're going to be screening it tonight. Part of the documentary is this really interesting history of women in the film industry. Mick LaSalle, he's a critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, he's in the documentary, and we talked to him this week about this brief period of time, about 5 years, from 1929 to 1934, where women were writing their own scripts, actresses were demanding more interesting parts. It all came to a crashing halt in the summer of 1934 when a new motion picture production code was introduced. The code prohibited storylines that didn't hold to traditional values and traditional roles. Basically, it censored American movies. But LaSalle says that brief period pre-code was really great for making honest movies, and it was great for women.
In 1933, 61% of the movies starred a woman. Before 1925, women in films were characterized in one of two ways. Either an ingenue, an unmarried woman, very sweet, who definitely didn't have anything resembling a sex life, or would be a vamp, and that would be a woman who did have a sex life and was evil and wanted to destroy men. In the pre-code period, you have actresses like Barbara Stanwyck.
She locked the door, tore my dress, I called for help, I had to kill her.
Kay Francis.
For a month, marriage was thrilling and exciting, and it became dull.
What?
Unbearably dull.
Katharine Hepburn at the beginning of her career, Betty Davis at the beginning of her career, Anne Harding.
I know you'd hardly expect that of a man father's position, but the fact of the matter is, money is our god here.
Linda, I'll...
Miriam Hopkins.
Stevie, I've wanted to marry you ever since I was little. But I won't.
These women who are having careers, who are having babies out of wedlock.
No.
I would say at least 50% of the screenwriters in those days were women. And so they were bringing their sensibility, and it was an uncensored sensibility, fortunately, to the movies, and they were improving movies. What you were seeing on the screen was something very new. You were seeing a new American woman that didn't exist 15 years before. And these were women who were availing themselves of, for example, contraception. So they were able to be adventurous, and they were able to be free. So movies were able to just give the breadth of a woman's experience. And that gets cut off on July 1st, 1934. Once censorship came in on July 1st, 1934, the most immediate thing is that every actress had to get her virginity back, and if she didn't get it back, she was in big trouble. Second thing is that women stopped being portrayed as professionals, and also women were second-class citizens in their marriages. If a man cheated on a woman, she had to take him back. If a woman cheated on a man, she ended up dead or absolutely disgraced. You have a whole generation from 1935, let's say, to the early 60s, where romance begins to seem phony because it's completely separated from sexuality. And so you have romance without sexuality, which just seems corny. And then what happens when the code goes away and we have the new rating system, the MPAA thing, which we have today, since 1968. Then we have sex without romance. We had romance without sex, and then we have sex without romance. And what do you have sex with? Usually, maybe violence. It just kind of gets bad. But just in the last few years, there really is a change. I mean, in 2017, women starred in about 20% of the movies. In 2018, women starred in 33% of the movies. In 2019, in 34% of the movies. And at like 35 or 36 in 2022. So I think something has changed and changed for the foreseeable future. But it's taken since 1934 to 2018 to even begin to recover. So, you know, this code was a very bad thing.
The film critic Mick LaSalle, he's featured in the documentary Body Parts. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the film and about how women's bodies are portrayed in the movies. But it's also a conversation about consent and how women are reclaiming their role in the film industry. One of the things the film examines is the role of intimacy coordinators in the industry. When a film or television show has a scene that involves sex or nudity or really any kind of intimate physical contact, an intimacy coordinator is there to help choreograph the movement, but they're also there to be an advocate for the actors. Jessica Steinrock is an intimacy coordinator. She joined us this week, and she explained how this is a relatively new job and how for years actors had been asking for someone to help negotiate the delicate physicality of these scenes. Steinrock says this came up a few years ago on the set of the HBO show The Deuce.
Actress Emily Mead is the one who went to producers as they were about to start season two and said, look, season one had a lot of intimate moments. And if you've watched season one of The Deuce, you will know she's not kidding. There is some very extreme stuff that happens in that show because it's a show about filming pornography.
Shoot, thoroughbred like you, we would own this damn street.
I'm doing fine.
So they're trying to figure out on HBO how to show the filming of pornography, which is going to involve a lot of prosthetics, a lot of graphic situations, etc.
I take care of my own self.
And Emily makes this very astute observation that for every other specialized scene, there is someone on set who is there to advocate for that specialty. If there's a stunt, there's a stunt coordinator. If there is a bug on set, there is a bug wrangler. If there are children, there is a studio teacher. There are so many of these specialized roles, and yet Emily was experiencing all through season one being put in these incredibly vulnerable situations that she says, hey, isn't there someone that can support me and someone who can support my colleagues? And it's no shock to anyone that there is a torrid history of this work being done in ways that are very unsafe that have caused a lot of harm. This is when the production company reached out to a woman named Alicia Rodas, who is a dear friend and mentor of mine. And Alicia was working on some of this work on some indie projects and also was working predominantly in live theater. And they said, hey, can you do this for us? And she hit the ground running on season two, helping to build a complete new suite of protocols for that show. And the success of her work on that show led HBO to making a commitment publicly, saying HBO is going to have an intimacy coordinator on every scene moving forward, which for a company like HBO is an incredibly huge commitment and has launched so much change and set such a precedence within this industry.
How significant was that moment, and why did it take until 2018, until someone like HBO makes a public statement saying, hey, we're going to do this in all of these in-house productions that we're doing?
You know, I think a lot of things were coming together again, right? We're seeing that cultural backdrop. But what we're also seeing is that there is more financial risk now than there was in the past for these scenes going poorly. We were seeing more lawsuits. We're seeing more media attention where projects are having bad PR crises related to how they're handling these kinds of scenes. And we also see a boom in positive PR when they talk about how these scenes are going well or how they are utilizing intimacy coordinators. And so I think a lot of the culture has come together to also create quite literally monetary benefit for the utilization of these specialists. Intimacy coordinators are insurance and also create better scenes of intimacy that audiences are more excited to watch.
When an actor sees a script and she sees that the role requires nudity, Will you talk about the decision that is going through her mind? And I know it's different for all different ones, but I suppose what I'm asking is, on one hand, they're probably thinking about the question of art, that being naked is an artistic choice for, you know, a director or a screenwriter or just important to the character, reveal something important about a storyline or a character. There's something visceral there, something real there. But then there's the really quite personal part that has to play into all of this. So what's the decision that's going on in an actor's mind when they're looking at this script that says nudity is going to be required?
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to that. So for instance, if the script says there's going to be nudity required, one of the big questions is what kind of nudity? You know, a lot of scripts I read say, like, they have sex, she is naked.
Yeah.
But and that can mean like 50 different things to me, right?
Yeah.
Like I can picture a lot of ways they have sex can look on screen. I mean, part of that's my job. But the other part, I think, is just, you know, no one knows what they have sex means. Mm. That's such a broad statement. And when we're thinking about purely in terms of what consent means, consent requires information. And so one of the kind of historical trends in the industry has been a pressure for actors to be a yes, to embody this idea of yes, to be game for anything, to be flexible and go above and beyond for the project. These are character traits that have been prioritized and ingrained in actor institutions, really from a cultural perspective. There's lots of cliches, too, that most people, even if they're not in the entertainment industry, have probably heard. Things like, if you won't do it, there's 100 people out the door who will, where actors are lauded for how deep they go into projects. You know, all of these things kind of create this culture around acting that very much pressures actors to, quote unquote, have no boundaries, which, you know, everybody has boundaries. And that's just kind of a fallacy where people are like, I have no boundaries. And they all have boundaries. Most people don't want to get punched in the face at work. There's boundaries there. But maybe to that example, I think that something that's very interesting is when you read a script that says he punches her in the face, when you read that script, you are not expecting to be punched in the face at work. You are expecting to have someone there, in this case, a stunt coordinator, who is going to work with you and the other actor to simulate that moment of violence in a way that keeps everybody safe and oftentimes takes into consideration things like wrist injuries, neck injuries, etc. However, when we read a script that says they have sex or she is nude, there is not kind of an expectation that there's going to be a way to fake that or mask it or have a body double or all of those other things. And this is also very different if that actor already has the part, and this is maybe season 2 or season 3 of a show, or if this is an actor who's trying to get the part, you know, trying to make it in an industry where work is scarce and competition is high. So all of these things are going into this decision of, am I comfortable with nudity? What kind of nudity? When? What's the stakes of this project? Did I know I was going to have to do this going into it? Who is this? Who am I doing it with? Where is this going to be distributed? How much of my body is going to be shown and in what lighting? How close up of a shot is my nipple going to be to the camera? How many people are going to be in the room? All of these questions will factor into what someone's specific boundaries are or are not, as well as adding in, have I done this before and are people expecting me to do it again because I was okay doing it before? It's a very complicated question and requires a lot of nuance. And for me, part of my job as an intimacy coordinator is to be a voice to talk through a lot of these kinds of questions so that when that person says, yes, I'm willing to do this, or no, I am not, they have as much information as possible and also are being reinforced with the belief that they have a right for their needs to be met, that if they have an injury, a boundary, a neck issue, that those aren't insurmountable issues, that we can navigate and work through to tell the story of nudity with the actor never even needing to be nude.
Let's talk about what exactly it is that you do One of the things you've said is that as an intimacy coordinator, you're trying to tell the story of a relationship between two people. Explain what you mean by that.
So my husband is a fight director, and something he's always said that I think is really lovely is that as a fight director, he often gets to come in and work on the biggest moments, the most climactic scene, and he gets to play with the scene that has the highest stakes and then kind of leave and doesn't have to do the rest of it. That's why he's a great fight director and not a great director.
Right.
I find a very similar sentiment in what I do as far as I love getting to walk in and work on these moments where an actor is almost always, their character is almost always changed before the scene of intimacy and after the scene of intimacy. And these stories of what does it mean for humans to connect emotionally, physically, for the stakes that usually are surrounding a scene of intimacy are very high. I get to come in and look at specifically those stories of two, sometimes more, people in love or in lust or in anger or hurt or pain. But those stories are so interwoven in the fabric of human society that they're some of my favorite stories to tell.
It's interesting. I've heard it described, intimacy coordination, as this balance between choreography and care. On one hand, you're choreographing this performed intimacy, in some cases sexual experience. On the other hand, you're also taking care here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the choreography part, though. What's that part about? Are you trying to make it look real, evocative? Like, what goes into that part of your role?
My answer to that really is I'm there to make it look the way the director and the actors want it to look.
Huh.
Sometimes I also get to have an opinion, but that's actually not required for me.
Mm.
I feel very passionate that my job is to really help fulfill the vision of the director within the boundaries of the actor.
Yeah.
You know, to do that involves helping simulate something to make it look like it's happening that's not.
Yeah.
So again, I make a lot of parallels to staged violence, but a fake punch makes it look like someone's fist is in contact with someone's face.
Mm.
Stimulated sex might make it look like someone's mouth is in contact with someone's genitals. Neither body parts have ever have to make contact.
Yeah.
And yet we can still tell that story through masking and choreography and simulation. But then you can add extra layers of choreography. So there's the magic tricks of making body parts look like they're doing something that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also things like opening and closing different body parts, exposing the neck, opening the arm, eyes open, eyes closed. All of those can be very deep storytelling moments. And the level of intricacy that I put in that really depends on whether or not the actors and director also want that level of intricacy. So I really do try to model my approach based off of how the director and actors also like to work. And so it can look very different from project to project.
Will you explain what a merkin is?
and
why that's important, that it's a barrier here, right? But it's such an important part of this. It's supposed to give a sense of it looking real, but it's not. Like, how are you thinking about and I think a lot of people will not know what that is. So just sort of take us through what that is and explain the importance of that kind of not just physical but almost psychological barrier that we're talking about with performers.
Yeah, let me actually offer a little bit of a clarification in some terminology that you're using.
Okay,
so
right.
A merkin is a pubic wig.
Right.
So quite literally some fake pubic hair that the makeup or special effects department will utilize to make it look like someone has pubic hair when they do not. Typically, merkins are used for pieces that are taking place at a period of time where pubic hair was more common. But the merkin itself is
that's not an aesthetic piece. So that's not
yes.
the barrier, right?
Correct.
Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
A barrier, yes. The terminology for barrier is quite literally just barrier. And so what I think there's two distinctions I make. There's a modesty garment and there's a barrier. And those are two separate things.
Huh.
So modesty garments are things like strapless thongs. They're regular thongs. They can be boy shorts. They can be the modesty pouches. Those are modesty garments,
yeah.
meaning they're just pieces of fabric that cover up an actor's genital area when it's not going to be exposed on film. But we also now have additional requirements surrounding the use of barriers. And a barrier is anything that prohibits sensation between actor genitals. And this is actually a relatively new requirement amongst filmmaking. Now, that's not to say it hasn't been utilized and there haven't been the use of different kinds of barriers for different kinds of things. But what we're seeing is a more regulations around the use of barriers and requirements for the use of barriers so that actors have a combination of modesty garment and barrier that prohibits sensation, but also is there for health reasons and makes the simulation significantly safer for all parties involved.
Let's talk about the care part. So there's the choreography part. What is the care part? You're an advocate for them. I imagine that when a scene is playing out, you're looking for awkwardness, some sense of uncomfortability. It seems like there's a lot of empathy in this part of the job, I suppose.
Yeah, usually when I'm talking about what an intimacy coordinator does, I split it into three different categories, as do a lot of my colleagues. We talk about choreography, we're movement specialists, we are liaisons, meaning that we are there to help communication flow for the days leading up to that moment of intimacy. So again, as I was talking about costumers often not getting some of the information they need about how much skin is going to be shown or not shown.
Yeah.
Intimacy coordinators are there to make sure that they have the information that they need to do their best work, as along with communicating with the director and the actors and sometimes the legal department, etc. So that liaisoning is that coordinating part of the job is also very important. But then this third piece that I think is what you're getting at, I would call this advocacy.
Yeah.
So that's choreography, liaisoning, and advocacy are the three big words that I use. But this is the part where every actor deserves to have their boundaries and dignity respected at work.
Mm.
And this is where, you know, I'm trying to assess, have we actively spoken about what is going to happen? What are we assuming is going to happen? What are we actually communicating about? So a good example here is, have we said whether or not we're going to use tongues in the kiss?
Right.
Because this is something that oftentimes we don't like to talk about. It's really uncomfortable to say, are you okay if I put my tongue in your mouth? And so a lot of people just kind of want to gloss over that and instead, you know, just move right ahead into the scene. But that's where we can potentially have a miscommunication about what someone consents or doesn't consent to. And so what we want to do is increase our level of communication as an act of care. And then throughout that, we're checking in to say, you know, has anything changed? What might you need? I'm looking for nonverbal cues as well. Is someone tense? Do they look hesitant? Do they look like they themselves are having an emotional reaction that is different than what their character might be having? And have I given enough scaffolding? This is, again, why we spend weeks prepping for these scenes now. Have I given enough scaffolding so that the actor knows what avenues of support they have access to get their needs met so that they can do the best work possible? Because at the end of the day, it is actors will do their best work when they feel safe and respected at work and at ease. We get not great work when an actor has to protect themselves while trying to act vulnerable. So we're all in service of telling that story, and I believe that a care-based approach is going to give us the best story.
That's Jessica Steinrock. She's an intimacy coordinator and the CEO of Intimacy Directors and Coordinators. We're going to be screening the documentary Body Parts tonight at 7 at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details at radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. In the documentary Body Parts, the director, Angela Robinson, talks about how a lot of us, everyone is how she puts it, everyone learns how to behave from the movies.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about how we get our notions of romance and beauty and, of course, sex from the movies. And this is sort of something you've talked a little bit about, that a lot of people are learning about relationships and intimacy from the stuff we see on screen. What do you make of that? Like the relationship between like real sex and sex that people see on screen and what we know about or think about intimacy.
I think movies and television have such a powerful opportunity to create strong impact. I truly do, because I very much agree that that is how many people are developing their understanding of what sex and intimacy can look like, yeah, about how relationships can look. However, I think that the stronghold that the media industry has on that is a big challenge for us to think about just as a culture and as a society, and very indicative of a lack of intimacy education, actual intimacy education, and media literacy. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, I, as an intimacy coordinator, have maybe a minute of screen time with which to tell an entire intimate experience. And what this means is that in order for us to focus on the story of the intimacy, the actual mechanics might be very different than how they would otherwise look for those two people in real life. And so if we're basing our entire experience or an understanding of what human intimacy is off of what we're seeing on screen and in the movies, we're going to miss out on the other, I don't know, 59 minutes that could have been happening, you know, or more or less. There's such a range that we will never be able to fully demonstrate, and nor will be prioritized, because it's not going to actually serve the larger story of the piece to focus on those things. So you really have to kind of slice and dice and figure out which beats you want to hit. But without media literacy and intimacy education, it's going to continue to create skewed understandings of intimacy, particularly amongst young adults.
I know the history part of all of this is not necessarily part of your expertise, but I did want to ask you, because one of the elements in the documentary that they work through is that in the early days of cinema, there were more women writers and more women filmmakers. And the point is made that women writers portrayed women as, you know, in some cases sexually assertive or but differently. And the images of female bodies started to change once censorship sort of came into it, and it's sort of the historical story they play out. But I'm just wondering, what is your sense of the difference that it makes for there to be women in the, you know, writer's room, or for there to be a woman as a director, a filmmaker, in the way that bodies or intimacy even is conveyed? What's the difference, do you think, if there is?
Yeah, I mean, 100. I would echo that sentiment 1,000,000,000% that the more diverse voices we have in these creative positions, the more diverse perspectives we're going to see on screen. And when we're having, you know, many actors and frankly, many of the actresses as well are of a homogenous demographic, we're going to see that those same stories are getting told over and over and over again. And as those demographics begin to shift and we see more diversity of voices, more diversity of stories, we're noticing those changes cinematically with where the camera is pointed and for what. Remember how I was talking about slicing and dicing, because we only have a minute, which parts of the intimate experience land in that minute we're going to show is a very arguably political choice, that as we have more diverse filmmakers making those decisions, we are seeing a broader range. And I think that does nothing for us but create better cinema, better stories, and more representation for anybody watching these moments. And I hope we see more of it.
Do you worry that in this conversation there people will think that people are moralizing too much? Because the question sometimes comes up, like, how does a filmmaker use nudity? Like, when does it cross a line? What does it mean? Mm-hmm. Is this moment gratuitous, or is this moment actually crucial to the character development or the plot line or any of those kinds of things? This seems like a really – when you're talking about art, an art form – this seems really complicated, do you think?
Mm-hmm. I mean, here's what I will say. Do I worry? Yes, I worry about everything, but that's just me. But when I think about the broader picture and like, what does it mean for me and how do I personally navigate this landscape and this environment? Yeah. It really all boils down to consent. Mm-hmm. Is everybody fully aware of the story they're telling, how their body is going to be used, what the purpose of this piece is? And have we communicated that clearly so that everybody is artistically consenting to tell the same story as one another? Because there are going to be films that I look at and I say, you know, I don't love that. I think that's gratuitous. I don't think the story really needed that. But that's okay. I think that we will always have, like, there's no such thing as perfect cinema. And so for me, what's important is that the people who made that piece walked away feeling proud of the piece that they made. And you know, people also change their mind retroactively. But in that moment, while they were filming, were they treated with care and compassion? Did they have all of the information? Were they able to say no without negative repercussions? And if those things are true, then that to me is an ethically made piece. And whether or not I agree with, you know, with the story they actually all decided to tell, it's more important to me that the piece itself was made ethically than it is, do I agree with that story as a whole?
The director, Karen Kusama, who's in the documentary, has said that having an intimacy coordinator, she said, doesn't just make the place safer, doesn't make the environment safer, but it also makes for, this is how she put it, for better, sexier art. What is she getting out there? Because it sounds like something you've talked about. The intimacy can be better, I suppose.
Yeah. When we're a phrase I like to use a lot is, what does everybody need to do their best work? And that's really where I try to center things from, is I'm not here as a police officer telling people what they can and can't do or where hands can and can't go. And these are the rules. And, you know, I'm really trying to say, like, what does everybody here need to build an environment in which they can do their best work and bring their whole selves safely to the piece? And so, again, kind of, I said something very similar earlier in this conversation, that when an actor is charged with both protecting their bodies and themselves and also trying to act, we're never going to get as good of pieces. And historically, this is kind of what's happened, is that actors haven't had a lot of spaces where it was okay for them to say, hey, I actually don't really like my stomach touched. That's going to take me out of the moment. I don't really like that. That's a boundary for me. Because they're afraid that and the power dynamics are so insanely high in Hollywood, but they're afraid that if they say, I don't like this, that they're going to be labeled as difficult, that they're going to be labeled as somebody who's just making things harder or more complicated. And so people often stay quiet. That silence can be very, very deafening, in that they are just hoping, or maybe they subtly move their body, but now they're not only in the moment, but they're monitoring where hands are going on their body, where they're not going on their body. Are they okay with this? Are they so not okay with this that they are actually going to say something? Or are they not okay with it, but maybe they'll just kind of tough it out for this moment? Right. And all of that extra emotional labor means that that is parts of that actor that they are not actually giving fully to that scene. And so when there is a level of trust and clear communication and clear avenues for support and an acknowledgement that if you say no, people will believe you and celebrate your boundary, then what we're going to get is actors saying yes a lot more. They're going to say, yes, I want to do this. Yes, let's give it a try, because they also know that they can change their mind later. So we get bolder, more daring actors with stronger trust bonds with each other that creates more dynamic cinema, better scenes of intimacy overall.
Let me ask you finally, right now in filmmaking in 2023, is intimacy coordination a standard or an exception?
That's a great question. Well, we're right now in the middle of the SAG-AFTRA-ACTORS strike, which is a really important and historical moment for the acting industry as a whole. But what's something that's very exciting is that SAG-AFTRA has released some of the things that they have agreed on and some of the things that are still up for consideration. But one of the things that is in a tentative agreement that producers will, in good faith, attempt to hire intimacy coordinators for any scene that involves simulated sex and nudity, which I think speaks volumes to the fact that producers also see a great value in this role. I would say it is, when it comes to SAG-AFTRA projects, large-scale productions, the vast majority of them are utilizing intimacy coordinators at this point. And as more and more trained and qualified intimacy coordinators enter the market, I only see that saturation continuing to grow.
Jessica Steinrock, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Steinrock, she's an intimacy coordinator and the CEO of Intimacy Directors and Coordinators. We're going to be screening the documentary Body Parts tonight at 7 at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details at radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about how women's bodies are portrayed in the movies. It's the subject of the latest documentary in our film series. It's called Body Parts. We're going to be screening it tonight at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. The director, Christy Guevara Flanagan, and the producer, Helen Hood Shear, joined us earlier to talk about the film. Guevara Flanagan went first. She underscored one of the points made in the film, that pretty much everyone learns how to behave from the movies. It's where we get our notions of romance and beauty and sex.
It's much more than entertainment. It's showing us how to be. And if you're seeing something over and over again, a woman undressing or a young woman undressing for male pleasure, that seeps in your own intimate relationships. And what is attractive, what is desirable. I think it can really rock your own sense of self and self-worth and complicate how you understand love and romance and these really basic relationships that are such a big part of our life. These messages get thrown at us from a very young age. You know, little girls knowing that they are given more attention for the way they look. That kind of grows up from there to then you have young women deciding how they're going to walk through the world based on the images they've been consuming for their entire lives. And also boys, too, the images of what it means to be masculine, what kind of a partner you should be, what feelings are okay to express and not express. It limits all of us, really.
I want to ask you about the use of archival film. It's so critical to the way the film moves and the way the film conveys the points that are being made by these actors who are experiencing these things. Talk a little bit about the footage, because it's interesting, and this is one of the things you sort of have mentioned to us, that on one hand, what you're seeing in these clips from film after film after film are these patterns that are there. But also you've talked about how you wanted to also use that archival imagery or these images as a way to kind of, I think you've put it, disrupt that pattern. Talk about that, if you would.
So it was definitely a long process to gather all the archival images that we used. We wanted it to reflect decades of filmmaking and different genres. We definitely had to also early on wrap our heads around how to show scenes and imagery that was not overly re-exploiting the female body, that could speak about what scenes people had done, women had done that maybe they weren't so happy with or had felt coerced or not proud of, but to not re-traumatize those people in showing those imageries. Thought about ways with animation and filming through different lenses to kind of create a distance or to cover up or really reclaim the image in some way. And it was always this delicate balance that we were trying to ride of illustrating what people were talking about and letting audiences see for themselves and then not using them in an exploitative way.
It was also a strategy from the beginning to play with the Hollywood archive in that way of showing patterns of behaviors, of image styles, of image content, and not to talk about a film and then show clips just from that film. The goal from the beginning was really to use a wide array of films in a sort of pastiche to provide, you know, a more biting cultural comment.
The actor Emily Mead says in the film that having a producer or a director say, "Are you okay with this or with this or with this?" You know, go down the checklist. She says it's just not a very thorough or good way of defining boundaries. How did the actors that you talked to say it should work? What was your sense of the way they thought it should? I mean, we'll get to the idea of whether it's changing, which it seems to be, but how did the actors talk about the way they wanted it to work?
I think there was definitely a difference in terms of the generation. Huh. I think actresses from an elder generation didn't even know they had a lot of choice.
Yeah.
I think they were pretty shocked, not at what was revealed by Time's Up and Me Too, but by the women that came forward and were asking for change in so many different aspects of the industry. You know, they worked so hard to get into this male-dominated industry, and they had to suffer a lot to be there and to make their place. And I think it's definitely this younger generation that are really asking questions about why it has to be this way and what would be more appropriate. And more information is better, more of what the scene will be and what is being asked of you. There's also a tendency that happens in the writing space where these intimacy scenes are underwritten. And so there's not a lot of information. All of a sudden it becomes a little bit like a music video, and there's, you don't know what is being asked of you. I think that having somebody who's not in a position of power asking somebody who's lesser of a position of power in the heat of the moment, "Are you going to do this?" That's a very uncomfortable place to be. And so having somebody neutral who's really involved in regulating what the negotiation process and just even the basic communication process is helpful. Just, you know, transparency, better communication, neutral people to go to so that you're not, it's not you against a production company. You know, you actually have the power to say no.
Yeah.
And agency. Yeah, I think it really comes down to agency. And it wasn't until 2019, I think, that SAG-AFTRA really made a demand that auditions not happen in hotel rooms or homes. Until then, that was often the case, and that wasn't a very safe environment either.
I want to ask you about this paradox or this contradiction that you get at a few points in the film, and that is why it is that nudity is thought of differently on screen for women and men. And who's making the rules, as the actor Alexandra Billings says, penises are pornography, tits are art. It's kind of the perfect way to describe it.
Well, it is kind of the million-dollar question. patriarchy, I guess, would be the simplest and shortest answer. We have such a history of a visual culture that is, you know, puts women up to be looked at and longed at. And it's hard to get away from that. I think it's hard even for women directors and cinematographers and writers to not lean into this wholly ingrained way of depicting visual pleasure, to get film theory on it. And Part of it must have to do with the rating system, which is a highly secretive entity. What gets a PG versus what gets an R? And it's long been said that male frontal nudity will get a higher rating in terms of, you know, the rating system than female frontal nudity, which is seen as, you know, PG and something that we're used to and is not offensive. It is a paradox and it's ingrained and it's hard to democratize.
I wanted to ask about impact. What have you learned about the impact this has? In particular, I was thinking Jane Fonda talks about how she thinks that this imagery and the way it's been handled, I guess, really does damage to girls. What do you understand? What do you think about the impact of all of this?
It's really hard for girls and young women to let go of this pressure to be recognized for what they look like and to be valued for that instead of just being valued for their intellect or their strength. We see this in just every level, every facet of our culture, from how female politicians and female athletes are minimized in talking about their bodies in ways that male athletes and male politicians aren't necessarily. So just it's happening on every level. And so the impact is profound and vast. And again, it harms both men and women. I think that men and women, young men and women, are just learning what are their roles based on these gender stereotypes. And it's also very limiting to women just in terms of who gets to be seen as attractive. Like, that's another aspect to it. Body size, skin tone, build and stature and ability-wise, that there are so many facets to the ways in which attractiveness has been very narrowly defined. That also has an impact on young people.
And we don't think this is just about the film industry. It really connects to all industries, all facets of life, and older women too, whether they're deemed as valuable members to society.
What's the education part that you're interested in now? So you've created this film. It gets the conversation going. What's next in terms of the conversations you're having, how you're trying to get people to talk about, you know, approaching filmmaking in different ways, and the reaction that you're getting, the educational part, if that's the right way to put it?
Sure. We're both professors and know that students are grappling with making their own films and wanting to do things in a way that is ethical and is representing broad points of view, but don't necessarily have the skills yet to do so. So we're definitely interested in our impact and educational campaign and trying to help the next generation of filmmakers. And we're also really interested in basics of media literacy, like you said. We'd love people to be able to watch our film and think more about the media that they consume. We've sort of compared it to reading the ingredients list on foods. People think about what they put into their body and how the food is made. And we'd like people to think about the way films are made, the entire arc of the labor process, and to really think about how bodies are shown in film, the sort of mechanics of shots, and what could be done differently to show perspectives that are more authentic and varied, like the population.
Thank you both very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Helen Hood Cheer, she's producer of the film Body Parts. She runs the documentary program at California State University, Long Beach. Christy Guevara-Flanagan directed the film. She's head of the documentary program at UCLA. We're going to be screening Body Parts tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll get started at 7. You can get details at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email comments or questions or suggestions to radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Our intern is El Cowley. Our executive producer is Carrie Watson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.